breathing treatments would maybe put him out. Certainly it was going to blunt his higher mentation. So I said, yeah, okay, that's good, let's do that. But with one proviso, I have a brother who my father was estranged from, hadn't talked for 20 years. And I said, he's coming from the Buffalo, New York area to here. Let's hold off the breathing treatment for now.
Yeah.
So he got a chance in it,
Yeah.
to make peace. And then with that breathing treatment, my father passed away.
Yeah.
Right? You know, on the very first breathing treatment, they had the Dilaudid in it. So there's a lot of, there's just all kinds of things that come into play there. Because the Dilaudid wasn't intended to kill him, but the pulmonologist and I both knew that there was a significant likelihood that it would. Yet, at the same time, it was palliative and it was to manage pain.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
To continue the breathing tube for maybe 4 or 5 more months, be away from his family, and don't want to be there. So that was the issue. But to me, the first question is: it more morally permissible to move his food and water? I'd say no on that one because that's
because
the care.
Tube, though, tube. So if they're not, if they're non-responsive, and they're not taking by mouth, and their kidneys are shutting down, and they're not, then you're
What if the treatment is more of a burden than it is a benefit to the patient? And what if it's increasing their suffering in that case? Would you still think it's wrong to remove it?
More of a burden?
It doesn't help them anymore. The water tube, the feeding tube does not help them anymore. You want to keep their mouth dry because that's moist. You know, I'm sorry, moist. You don't want their mouth to get dry, like I just did, dry mouth. What about then? Would you think it would be okay to withhold it then? Well, let's assume for this case that his decision-making ability is now out of the equation. You're the family member. Can you withdraw the water and food?
I think you have so much more information being the family member. Are they still producing urine? If they have no output, then their kidneys are shutting down. Residual every time you're putting into the tube. So I think you would just have more. If they're not using the food and the water.
Yeah.
In that
case, the food is keeping up with his dialysis. He's having daily dialysis. And if you give him too much of the food and the water, then the dialysis couldn't keep up. So he had to keep reducing the food. So the body was taking nutrition from his muscles. And
okay. Go ahead, Nate.
Subject that has come up to this degree before where we can pretty much blunt any pain and alter duration of life and maybe in the same way. So, you know, we have, as an affluent culture with the capability to control these things, an extreme aversion to discomfort and pain.
Sure.
That would not have been necessarily shared by every other culture that has ever existed. You know, you read the prayers of Christian men and women from other religions as well, even several hundred years ago, and the thought of a swift death was actually something that would have been intolerable to many of them. They preferred a slow, painful death that could focus the mind on the things that mattered. And I'm not saying that to be insensitive to
right.
anyone who's gone through that, but we do have to contextualize it in our particular affluent culture that is so averse to pain that we'll do anything.
Which Augustine challenged them on making that an idol, wanting to die a martyr and with suffering, and he came in and challenged that. But yeah, you're right that our culture wants to die easy, no pain, no problems, and anybody that wants to help me do that, if you won't help me do it, I'm going to force you to do it through the power of the state. Yeah, that no doubt about it. Let's talk just for a moment about doctor-assisted suicide and the argument against it, the moral argument, the biblical argument, and then we'll come back and see if this is different than that. And I'm going to argue it is, as I think you see where I'm going with this. But biblically, here's our syllogism. Get ready. This will sound familiar to you. Premise one. Anybody want to tell me what premise one is? It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Premise two. Doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia intentionally kill innocent human beings. Conclusion. Therefore, they're wrong. Right? There's our argument. Now, given that argument, as Christians, does it follow that we must always resist death? No, it doesn't. Death must not always be resisted. It's going to come to all of us. We are all going to face it. Some of you, I asked last night, how many of you have had loved ones who have had to walk through this? And a lot of you had. It's something that we all go through. And there is a distinction, in other words, between intentionally killing an innocent human being and withholding treatment that we basically say we're not going to resist the natural course of death anymore. We're going to let it take its course. That is very different than intentionally killing another human being. As a Christian, I think, too, we've got to be careful that we don't make this earthly life the ultimate good. It's not the ultimate good. Our ultimate good is heaven. And I remember a case at Biola when I was taking a class there. The professor talked about a friend of his. The family was so unwilling to let this old man die that they were subjecting him. He was 92 years old. And they were subjecting him to ongoing things so the family wouldn't have to deal with him passing. The guy wanted to die. He was old. He had disease. And they kept doing things. And one of the things that came up was a CPR procedure that was performed. I mean, that's not an easy thing on a healthy man, let alone someone who's 92. I mean, imagine the trauma to the body. This is the kind of thing that I think we need to reexamine as Christians. What is appropriate at that stage? And that's what we want to look at. I think we can get some help from ethics, too, here. You were onto something I think that's an important distinction, Mr. Powers. Aren't you impressed I got the name right? I mean, yeah. At Fort Wayne, I remember people's names because Wendell gets grouchy with me if I don't. What is our intent in holding back this treatment here? What are we trying to do? Let's start with the intent of the withholding before we talk about the morphine. What's our intent in withholding the treatment? Comfort. It's not benefiting him. It does no good to him. So you're not... And by the way, is it the withholding of the treatment that's killing the patient at this point? What's killing the patient? The underlying pathology, correct? So the physician is not actively or intentionally killing an innocent human being. The disease is doing that. He is withholding something that is no longer a benefit to the patient. But here we need to be very, very careful. Our culture has turned doctors into philosophers. And we shouldn't be doing that. A doctor is in a position to tell us that a treatment is no longer beneficial or valuable. He or she is not in a position, any more than any of the rest of us, to tell us of a human life, if a human life is valuable. You see that distinction? And what happens is we get worldview issues that come into play where the physician almost acts as a philosopher. I see this on the news all the time. They don't go to a philosopher or a theologian to ask the question, what's the right thing to do in an end-of-life decision? Who do they interview? The doctor, who makes a quality of life assessment, not a treatment assessment, a quality of life assessment about the person. And I think we need to be careful not to just punt to the people in white coats, unless their last name is Francis and they have philosophy training. Then maybe we will, but otherwise, no. They are in no more position than we are to make that decision. Let's go to the morphine. Can it hasten death? So does Coke. I gave that up last week. How about you? No. So does Coke. Coke causes what now?
Stuff like that. We eat and drink all sorts of things that hasten our death.
Is there no difference between something that is an immediate cause of a hastening of death and something like Coke that helps me write better books? What is going on with the morphine here? What are we doing? We're taking his pain away. Can you foresee death coming sooner? Now, here's another distinction we're going to make. Foresight versus intent. And we see this in a lot of bioethical issues. Ectopic pregnancy, for example. A woman is pregnant, but the embryo is implanted in the fallopian tube. The CDC website is pretty clear from what I've seen. This is a grave threat to the mother's life in most cases. If you don't intervene by ending the pregnancy, you're going to lose the embryo, you're going to lose the mother. So you're a pro-life physician, what are you going to do? Do nothing and let two people die? Or act in such a way that you save one life, even though the unintended but foreseen result is the death of the embryo? Everybody with me on this distinction? Now, in a Catholic some Catholic theologians, they're actually shifting their view on this a little bit right now. It used to be the only treatment they would accept would be literally surgically removing that portion of the tube with the embryo still in it and letting the embryo die naturally. It seems to me that's just unnecessary risk and surgical trauma for the mother that isn't required. But I think the more appropriate thing to do would be to say you're not acting to kill an innocent human being. You're acting to save the mother's life with the foreseen result that the embryo will die. Is the embryo going to die anyway?
Yes.
You can't save him. We don't have the technology to transplant him, to my awareness. So we act and do the greatest moral good we could. Same here, I think, in the sense that we're acting to relieve the patient's pain. We're not acting to intentionally kill him. And that is the big difference here. One other thought on ectopic pregnancy. I know that's not my topic in this session, but Christopher Kaiser makes an excellent point. He makes the argument that when we take the embryo out of its pathological environment, the tube, and actually remove it surgically, we have actually benefited the embryo by removing it from its pathological environment where it's going to die. And sure, death comes anyway. But the timing of the death doesn't change the fact that you've actually acted to improve the condition of the embryo. That could be debated, but just a little side note on that he throws out there. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about, well, first I want to read this from Gilbert Melander. This is just awesome. He says this, "The fact that we ought not aim at death for ourselves or for another does not mean we must always do everything to oppose it. Thus, rejecting a treatment that is burdensome is not a refusal of life. But here the physician must be both careful and honest," says Melander. "Instead of asking, is the patient's life a benefit to him, the physician should inquire, what, if anything, can we do that will benefit the life he has?" That is a great distinction. We're not comparing the patient to other lives that are healthy. We're asking the question, what is the greatest good we can do to benefit the life he has at the moment, the terminal condition he has. Our task, writes Melander, is not to judge the worth of this person's life relative to other possible or actual lives. Our task is to care for the life he has as best that we can. All right, now, is it possible that this whole morphine thing could get abused? Yeah, and I think it's reasonable. So, as a Christian, you're this guy's relative, family. What if the doctor says, I can give him a dose and we can pretty much take care of this now? Are we going there? Is it okay for terminal patients to sleep before they die? Meaning, if their pain is that bad, give them a strong enough dose to where they're essentially not conscious. I kind of walked through this from a little bit of a distance. One of my best friends growing up died of cancer last year. And he died young. I mean, he's only 55 when he died. And he had cancer, and it was all through him. He kept saying for the last 6 months, I just want to go home and be with Jesus. And his family did not know how to deal with this. Really tough thing for them. And I'd call him up, and I mean, he had shrunk down below 90 pounds. He was just really having a tough time. And he would kept saying, I just want to go be with Jesus. And what they did is near the end of his life, they were controlling his pain by giving him quite a bit of morphine, I think it was, whatever it was. But then, and I don't know how this works, Dr. Francis, but they were able to dial it back so that he would kind of come back and be aware, and he was able to make closure with some family members. And then they went back to controlling his pain again, and then he passed not long after that. But I was surprised, and it got me thinking that, yeah, we can control a patient's pain, we can let them sleep, but that's not the same as giving them a dose that kills them, a lethal dose that kills them. We're giving them enough to control the pain, but not enough to lethally close them. Okay, let's go ahead.
When you're unconscious, I was unconscious one time. I was completely aware of everything around me, even though my eyes were closed.
Yeah.
So you are aware.
When you're unconscious, you might be aware, yeah. Let's talk about this from a pastoral care perspective for a moment. What do you think we can do as a community of believers to help dying patients? What are some things you think we maybe ought to... We're going to have them in our churches. What are some things we can do? Here's a few suggestions. I think we have to help them finish well and have... Here's a phrase we don't hear anymore, but it is quite prevalent in past eras. We have to help them have a good death. That's not a phrase we like, is it? What does it mean to have a good death? Well, I think the culture would say not too much pain, make it easy and, you know. But what, as Christians, what does a good death mean? What does that look like?
Reconciliation with others and reconciliation with God, yes?
Yeah. God, as the giver of life, is also the arbiter of when it ends, correct? Yeah, so certainly. Yeah, that's part of a good death. It's interesting. Melander lists these things, these points as a good death. Scott Ray does as well. A good death is the culmination of a life well lived. It affirms the value of the person. It follows a change in longing from earth to heaven. Remember my friend Ken I just talked about? Last 6 months, I just want to go be with Jesus. I want to see Jesus, and I was glad that he did. Comes after closure with family and loved ones. Uses medical technology appropriately, meaning to withhold pain but not lethal doses, for example. Does not involve euthanasia or assisted suicide, and involves resting in Jesus, and brings people to God and glory to God. Scott Ray gives four things that dying patients need to hear. And these are things their family needs to hear as well. He says four things. They need to hear, I love you. A lot. A lot. Like walk in the room and that may be all you say. You don't worry about fixing it. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciation. And this, here's the two biggies. Forgive me and I forgive you. It's a big one. We have a family situation where we're moving very closely to dealing with this time in a relative's life, in my family. And I see the hurdles. This person desperately needs to say that. She has hurt a lot of people and needs to hear it where she's gotten it back. And that's one of the ways we bring closure. I think we also need to help church members apologetically on this issue, our high school kids and college kids. What's the big argument for doctor-assisted suicide in the culture? What's the number one thing you're going to hear?
It's a doctor that decides you to die.
Yes, but what's the rationale?
Death with dignity.
Death with dignity, sure. No suffering. But what's undergirding all of that?
Yeah, autonomy.
Autonomy.
You have the right to decide.
Autonomy. I am my own boss, I have absolute autonomy and especially bodily autonomy. That's what's driving the abortion debate. It also drives the doctor-assisted suicide debate. Okay. How can we help our students think about autonomy a little bit? How about this? If the right to die is based on autonomy, an absolute right to an autonomy, can it be limited to dying patients?
No.
It's got to be available to who?
Anybody who wants it.
Anybody that wants it. The publication, I think it's the New, I want to say New Economist. What's that left-wing journal? I'm going to have to look it up. I think it's the New Economist. Had an article last July that argued doctor-assisted suicide and specifically euthanasia should be practiced on anybody, regardless of age and regardless of physical condition, if they were so emotionally distraught they thought that their quality of life had been diminished. What? We're going to do this to children who happen to be depressed? All in the name of what? Autonomy. You got it. The problem here with autonomy, it doesn't work in the abortion debate either. I threw this out at a recent debate I had online with somebody. They were arguing for bodily autonomy. And I said this. I said, what if a woman is pregnant and she just decides she's not going to let the fetus pass beyond her cervix? My body, my choice. It's staying in there. By the way, I got this example from a guy who's a pro-abortionist, but he doesn't think the bodily autonomy argument works. Always fun to steal from the other side. And I said, what if she just decides my body, my choice? I have absolute bodily autonomy, and she leaves the child in the womb where he grows for the next 50 years until the mother dies. He wants out, but she's not going to let him pass. Assuming that could happen, would the mother be right asserting her right to bodily autonomy at that point? You see the absurd conclusions that can come from this. So autonomy is inadequate. The other thing you're going to hear justifying physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia is that our arguments against it are strictly religious. You're just bringing your religion into this. Can I help you out here? Whether it's abortion or doctor-assisted suicide, arguments are true or false, valid or invalid. Calling an argument religious is a category error, as Frank Beckwith points out, like asking how tall is the number 5. You got to refute our arguments. What argument? Our syllogism. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Doctor-assisted suicide does that, therefore it's wrong. They've got to refute that. It's not enough for them to call our argument a name. And I have seen the pro-life side dismissed on grounds that it's religious. It's not dealing with it. How about the argument for mercy? This is the Kevorkian argument. You Christians, you just don't have any mercy or compassion for people who are suffering from illness. You just want them to suffer. I can put them out of their suffering. In fact, your argument isn't even consistent with your faith. This is where we can now answer empirically. We can pretty much control people's pain. Pretty much. It is no longer the draconian choice, live and suffer or die and not suffer. We can actually control people's pain. And you know what the survey data is showing about people who know their pain can be controlled? They don't want to die. They don't want to die. They're worried that they're going to die. be a burden to their families, suffer a lot. We can control their pain. Then the other big argument for doctor-assisted suicide involves a worldview known as utilitarianism. I will now speak. That Chinese food that you sent us over to get. Utilitarianism is the belief that the good is defined by the greatest good for the greatest number. That's basically, in a nutshell, what utilitarian thinking is. We don't ask what is the objective true thing. We ask what's the greatest good for the greatest number, and that drives our decision making. And this certainly plays out in doctor-assisted suicide. But let me ask you a question. Do you see some problems with utilitarian thinking? What's a problem with it? I'll come back. The what? IPBA, okay. What if framing an innocent man would allow me to prevent a city from going into a riot? Say I'm the mayor of Ferguson, and I know if I frame this innocent dude, the crowd, the mob will go away. Yeah, that dude, he'll go to jail, and yeah, a little inconvenience there, he'll be locked up, but we save the city. That's the greatest good for the greatest number, right? What if torturing a child for fun allows 1,000 people to experience joy and only one pain? See, this is the problem with utilitarian thinking. What's the good, by the way? Can utilitarianism define the good for us? No, it has to go outside its theory and find something else to define the good. It can't tell us what the good is. It also doesn't do a very good job of giving me on decision-making authority. What's better? I've got $100,000. Give 1,000 people $100 or give $100,000 to a relief organization that will help feed people worldwide. What's the greatest good? Give the poor people a little bit of money or a relief organization a lot of money? How does utilitarianism give us any kind of guidance on that? It doesn't. So these are theories that I think we need to equip ourselves to answer in the culture. That's what's driving this. Okay. Question?
This is the culture of death, really. I notice it, like over in, is it Switzerland or Holland that's doing this?
Holland. Yeah.
My friend who lives in Holland, he's afraid for his elderly mother, thinking they're going to kill her because she's old and no longer useful.
Right.
As well as the disabled children are being killed off, too.
Right. You've got an issue with disabled people being killed off. And the problem here is we're making a judgment again about the lives being not valuable rather than treatment not having value. Physicians can tell us when a treatment isn't valuable, isn't helpful. They can't tell us when lives are. So let's just review what we've kind of talked about. We've got a difference between intending death and foreseeing death. We talked about that difference. We talked about withholding treatment that no longer benefits the patient, where the disease is what's killing the person, not the withholding of the treatment. And we've made it real clear that as Christians, we do not intentionally kill innocent human beings, but it doesn't follow from that that we must always resist death. It's coming to all of us. But we do need to make sure that we are not actively and intentionally killing an innocent human being. Okay, questions on doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia? Anybody not comfortable with this, what we said? You can speak. You can disagree with me, by the way. You're wrong, but you can... No. All right, let me challenge that a second. How many of you remember the Terri Schiavo case? She had been in a PVS, persistent vegetative state. And I think we can all admit it got really crazy down there. I mean, we had doctors diagnosing her from hundreds of miles away. And I will just say up front, I think our side blew it on the Terri Schiavo case.
Yes.
And let me tell you why. You know what our argument was? Our argument was, well, she could get better. Look, she recognizes her family. And that picture circulated, you know. What did we just concede with that? What premise did we just concede by saying she could get better?
Utility.
Utility, what else? A functionalist view of human value that says what gave her a right to life and her value was that, well, she could improve. Wait a minute. If all humans have value because they bear the image of God and thus should not be intentionally killed, she has value, she bears the image of God regardless of her functional abilities, correct? That's not the argument we made. We argued she could get better. And you had that Dr. Bill Frisk in the Senate who diagnosed her and said, yeah, I think she could get better. He's what, 800 miles away, you know, and the media just went crazy over this. I think we gave our opponents a premise we shouldn't have. That said, there are some Christian bioethicists that do not believe it was wrong to remove her feeding tube. What do you think? Yeah. Disabled. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
No, her whole family was all for her. It's just that her estranged husband was calling all the shots.
Right.
Yeah.
She was very inconvenient to him. Yeah.
He was suddenly able to remember everything she had ever wanted, though I doubt he could remember his to-do list when she was alive. You know, I mean, yeah. There was a case involving Karen Quinlan in the 70s. Some of you may remember this. The family... she was in an accident, and they had her on a ventilator. And somebody sued to have the ventilator removed, and those that wanted it removed argued that it was treatment and therefore could be withheld. That was their argument. So they pulled her off the ventilator, and she actually lived another 10 years in a persistent vegetative state. Then there was a similar case in the late 80s, Nancy Cruzan, I think was her name. And that was also a ventilator case, if I remember. And she died pretty quickly afterward. And then the other one being the Schiavo case, the big one. Yeah. Food and water treatment, or do we want to call those necessary things? I like your distinction, Dr. Francis, that in the case of... Chinese food is kicking in. The gal in Florida, Schiavo, she was not dying from an underlying illness. She was in a perpetual state. And what actually killed her was the withdrawing of the treatment. That was the proximate thing that killed her, not an underlying pathology. Great distinction. All right. Last, yes, back row. Yeah.
The society only has so many medical resources, and the idea of a condition that is less treated will determine what could be treated.
Let me refer you to a book that deals exactly with this question that you've just brought up of medical rationing. It's by Wesley J. Smith. It's called The Culture of Death. And the subtitle is How Medicine is Killing Us, I believe is the subtitle. He goes in there and he cites case after case where patients were denied care that should have been given it. For example, an aging grandma in her late 80s has a urinary tract infection and the hospital refuses to clear it up with antibiotics. Steve Weimer, who works on my staff, his mother died last July at 93. For the last 2 years, the hospital would refuse to treat her and they would only recommend, the only thing they would do was sign a hospice order. That was it. And Steve had to go all over creation to find people to just clear up normal stuff. Like, can she have an antibiotic for an infection? And his mom lived 2 years. She wasn't at death's door. She's just old. And the idea was exactly what you're saying, the rationing of the care. And Wesley J. Smith in that book deals with that very well. He's a very good colleague. Real quick, yeah.
My husband's late mom, she had cancer.
Yep.
She refused to eat on her own.
Right.
The day before she died.
Well, and that's fine if the patient refuses it. Yeah, forcing it. Yeah. Yep. All right. Go ahead. Yeah.
Even though the food and water debate can be really tricky, in something like this, I don't actually think that it is. Yeah. But with a ventilator case where that is sustaining their life, and you have instances where, you know, people have suffered really traumatic injuries and have been told, families have been told that there's no brain activity.
Yeah. Two issues. Yeah.
How you would address that.
Sure. Two issues. The question is a ventilator. You really actually almost brought up two things. One is would be you're basically dead. You're no hope of recovery. We'll use the term brain death here for lack of a better term. When we talk about someone who's brain dead, they are dead. The body is no longer functioning as a coordinated whole. There's been an irreversible loss of the body's ability to function that way. And if you unplug life support, the body begins decomposing immediately. There could be reasons why family doesn't want that to happen, but that's, we had a case locally where there was this kid with a fatal disease he had, and he managed to live long enough to graduate high school, but he actually died 4 days before the graduation date, and so his family asked that he be kept on life support so it could be said that he lived to graduation day. And it was a big local story in my hometown, and the guy, that's when they unplugged him and he died. But they didn't kill him by unplugging him. He was already dead. His body had shut down, but the so-called life support, for lack of a better term, was preventing his organs from decomposing. I don't see anything that would cause a Christian to say, you've got to leave that person hooked up when they're gone. Ventilators are tricky because, as you say, you know, a lot of people that go on them, they never come off them. And what do you do with that? I mean, they would be dead were it not for the fact that there's artificially, we're pumping oxygen through them. I guess you're going to have to take that one case by case. Is there a permanent... If they fit the criteria of death, meaning there's been an irreversible loss of coordinated brain activity, including the brain stem, not just frontal lobe activity, then they're gone.
And I think too, you can make a distinction of if they still have coordinated function of their
right.
major organs. I mean, just like
then they're
dialysis,
alive.
If you take somebody off of dialysis
right.
and don't have any other mode of treatment, they're going to die.
Right. Yeah.
To be taken off the ventilator.
And he died.
So he was communicating and saying he did not want
yeah.
to be taken off the ventilator.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think it's a really slippery slope then.
The definition of death is also shifting. The classical definition of death is irreversible cessation of the entire brain, including the brain stem. We're now moving toward more of a whole brain death theory that says what really should define death is loss of cognitive ability. Peter Singer is pushing for this and other ethicists. that when you lose consciousness, that's when we go ahead and make you a candidate for being declared dead. It would allow easier organ retrieval. That's the theory behind it. Yeah.
When does the soul leave the body?
Hold on just a second. I'm going to get this man. Go ahead.
Covered people in a coma.
Yeah.
Sometimes they come out of a coma.
Yeah. Sometimes they do. We had that case last year of that guy that was in one 35 years, and he came out, and I forget what his, one of his first questions was something about his sports team he liked, you know, and we had to give him the bad news. They're just as bad now as they were, you know.
Yeah, Cubs fan.
Yeah, sorry. Nothing's changed. Go back, you know. All right, we're going to take a break unless there's a final question. Real quick, it has to be fast because we got to take a break.
When you're brain dead, that means your soul is dead.
When you're dead, you're dead. When you're brain dead, you're dead. If you are, in fact, brain dead, because in a mature organism, the brain coordinates the bodily systems. Now, an embryo doesn't need a brain to live, does it? Something else is coordinating its various systems, so its internal growth continues. But when you are an older person, the brain takes that over. When you're no longer in the embryonic stage, once you have a brain, that's what's coordinating the bodily system. So when that ceases, you die. All right. Yeah. I do. Oh, I did.
Okay, I'll ask you a question.
Go ahead.
I just had back surgery, and my wife here said, I don't want anything special done for him.
Yeah.
You know, and it was outpatient surgery.
Weaver, I tell you, it was outpatient. How much life insurance does she have on you? That is unreal. I mean, okay, I'm kidding. No, that you're just being funny. That's good. All right. I have a professor at Biola. Nate may know who this is, Scott Ray. I'm going to reopen this. Just for, he's good, actually. He's outstanding. But he actually has argued that in the case of Shivo, that we could make a very good case that what was being removed was treatment, and that maybe we are being too quick to keep people here that would die naturally from their injuries. Because he would argue if this were 100 years ago, she would just be dead. But technology has afforded us a means of keeping her alive, maybe. I don't know. He's arguing maybe we shouldn't. You want to take him on, anybody, based on what we've said here? That was my comeback to him. He seemed to think those fell within legitimate treatment categories where the air and or the water and feeding tube did not.
Water and feeding tube were always traditionally, water and nutrition and hydration, generically, were always regarded as, that's really not treatment, that's just what we do, you know.
Yeah.
And everything's changed because when that ethic was vibrant and robust, we didn't have PEG tubes, we didn't have feeding tubes that could easily be put in with just a little bit of conscious sedation. Yeah. Now we have that, so it's changed the calculus a little bit about nutrition and hydration. Plus, I don't know whether it's true or not, because I'm not a physician, but there's a lot of people mm-hmm. that are medical ethicists who are physicians who say that continuing nutrition and hydration, even small doses with a feeding tube, actually makes the dying process, not only prolongs it, but makes it more painful.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't stick an IV in, a PICC line in, and a PEG tube in.
Yeah, if you're actually dying. It is a question here. How much are we going to subject dying patients to treatments that are burdensome and tough to deal with? Now, what would you do, just a pastoral concern here, you got a dying loved one, they don't know Christ, and they're slipping away, we're at that terminal stage, and you're... Because this is kind of what I'm facing in our family situation. It's not an immediate family member, but this is a relative who does not, to my knowledge, know Christ. And I've been trying to make conversation that way. But suppose we're at that point where Do we continue to use treatment or not? What does that change anything in your thinking, or is it? That's toughening it up, isn't it? Yeah. What would you do in that case? It's a loved one who, I mean, do you do everything possible because of the eternal thing, or does there come a point where you do trust in the sovereignty of God and that guides you no matter what?
That's where I cross over and become a Calvinist.
Yeah. It takes that for you to cross over?
Yeah. It takes at least that.
Well, Wendell's bringing me back on that subject next month. Yeah. No.
By becoming a Calvinist.
Yeah.
Your mental faculties aren't there anyway. If you haven't made a decision to come to Christ when you did have the ability, then it's unlikely that you're going to come.
Well, you know, sometimes you'll get people who say, well, we're just going to keep all these treatments going because we want God to work a miracle. Well, if you really want God to make a miracle, let's unplug everything and see what happens, right? Yeah. I mean, I do think as Christians we need to recognize that not only is God the author of life, He is sovereign in salvation too. And that means that I'm not a soul winner. I proclaim truth, but God's got to do the work. God has to do that work of regeneration. And you're right, the Calvinist has a little bit easier out on this one. But still, there is trust in God that He is the one sovereign in salvation. And that guides us more than this desperate, we're always going to push forward. All right, any other questions before? Yes.
I wonder if one of the problems is just the economics. You can't afford expensive treatments that will only prolong life a short period of time.
Yes.
That was Richard Lamb's thing, the governor
of governor Colorado.
Yeah.
You have a duty to die, said Lamb.
Yeah.
Unless you're wealthy enough to pay for it.
Well, by the way, you're not talking fiction, because in the Netherlands we have it documented that voluntary euthanasia has morphed over into involuntary on grounds of medical rationing.
Yeah.
That's documented. It's not even debatable. It's in the literature. So that does indeed happen. You mentioned Richard Lamb. Do any of you remember him, the governor of Colorado, who, when he was governor, not only advocated for euthanasia, but said that older people had a duty to die. You know, that's always interesting. Where does an atheist like him get a sense of a duty? We apparently have no moral rules except one, get out of the way, you know? Yeah. I saw that hand. Yes, Nate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Would any of you, would you sign a DNR? Do not resuscitate. That's where you give an advance directive to the, it's not an advance directive, but order to the hospital staff. Basically, if you go code blue, do not, no CPR, no. I mean, you right after that lunch we just had at that Oriental place. No. As you approach, you know, let's say you're, would you want your family?
Oh, my mother, 95, yes, we have a DNR.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
my
dad. Yeah. You see anything wrong with that?
They're starting to call it allow natural death. The thing has shifted in a lot of institutions from DNR to allow natural death.
Mm-hmm. Of course, then it gets, the devil's in the details. What do we mean by natural death? Yeah. Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah, DNR where you say no extraordinary treatment. The rub becomes what becomes defined as extraordinary treatment. And without good moral compass, that's where we're going to be in trouble. All right, yes.
Do
He had a change of heart? I'm sorry, that was bad. Go on. Yeah. Well, if he is still within his cognitive abilities to direct his own wishes, then, yeah. I'll say this much. I don't want you killing me, but I sure don't want to stay here any longer than I have to when the time comes. And I am quite ready to go home and be with Jesus. There are days I feel like that already, and I'm not even, I'm not even at the elderly state, and I think we can all say that that is what, if you're a Christian, your heart should long for that. You don't want to, you want to glorify God as long as you can here, but you're like Paul. Hey, our home is heaven. So, all right.
Well, based upon that, I'm going to tell you to tie your shoe there because so you don't die early.
Yeah, that could be a problem.
Lace there.
Yeah, that could be a problem. All right, we are going to take a short break. I'm getting you out of this session a little bit early. And we're going to come back and we're going to get, this is, I think the next session is where we're going to have a little bit of fireworks, because we're going to talk about a little bit of genetic stuff that involves, are we healing the body or enhancing it? And where is that going in terms of our culture? And you heard of the transhumanist movement, where we literally redefine human nature and transcend natural limits? We'll talk a little bit about that. I'll give you a case study to look at. So, how long is the break?
Well, 10 minutes. No later than 2 o'clock, sure.
Okay, you got till 2 o'clock. He gave you 3 extra minutes. Go before he has a change of heart. It's all right. No worries.
Just real quick, were you going to address living will versus personal medical document? Yeah, whatever they are?
Bring that up. Point. Yes, okay. Bring that up in the Q&A. I'd love to talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We had a battle within our own family over my parents.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how you felt about it. I'm a little concerned about living wills.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to.
We had a pretty wide gamut. You know, my one sister.